Lawrence Pinkley's Casebook, Volume 1. Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Lawrence Pinkley. I'm a private detective. There aren't many 18-year-old detectives in Whitby. In fact, I'm the only one. But not by choice. I found myself pulled into the cold northeast of England following the death of my father, when I unwillingly inherited the Pinkley Investigation Group, or PIG for short. The Mystery of the Vanishing Fish, where Pinkley is called in to investigate a shipment of fish that seems to have impossibly vanished from inside a locked warehouse. It had been a peculiar week in Whitby that started when a vicious storm blew in from the North Sea and crippled the migration of tourists to the town, who decided instead to stay inside their guest houses and played board games until it was safe to venture out again. The storm had not left the town without damage. The chimney stack at 82 Malady Place had toppled over, falling through the roof into Mrs. Chubb's bathroom, exposing her bunions and an awful lot more to a row of weather-beaten seagulls. The shock was enough to cause them to lose their footing and slip into the narrow alley between the Chinese takeaway and the pillow factory. Either owner would gladly take advantage of an animal that strayed too close to their establishment as a way of cutting down their raw material costs. All 57 inmates from Mrs. Meekin's cat sanctuary had escaped after the fencing securing the property had collapsed. The winds were so strong that even the famous Whitby Abbey, perched high above the town, was blessed with a shroud made from seaweed. When the storm finally ended, the sea retreated to reveal a stranded mink whale lying stranded on the beach. The media attention it grabbed soon encouraged tourists to put down their dice, quickly guess that Colonel Mustard did it with the candlestick in the library, and rush back into town to see the spectacular sight and the complicated rescue operation that followed. Storms also meant that the services of a private detective were not needed. After all, if everyone stayed indoors, nothing happened. But as soon as Whitby got back to normal, I found myself down by the harbour talking to Victor Stickleback, an eccentric local fisherman with a permanent sunrash across the middle of his face. He wore a large yellow waterproof overalls, and there was an overpowering smell of fish coming from him. "One minute they were here, the next they had disappeared," said Mr. Stickleback. We were standing on a wooden slatted wharf with the North Sea wind blowing on our backs. In front of us was a row of 8 identical warehouses painted duck egg blue, each one only distinguishable from its neighbour by the square white number plaque that was screwed beside each door. "And what time was this?" I asked with my pen poised over the notepad, trying not to breathe whenever the wind blew Mr. Stickleback's fishy aroma in my direction. "Just gone 5 this morning. I hadn't been out for 4 days because of that storm, and this being market day, I needed to earn some money. I remember hearing the town hall clock chime in as I steered old Betty into the harbour. Pulled up over there." Mr. Stuckemack pointed to a tired-looking fishing boat, its paint blistered and peeling from the hull. I tied her up as usual, took off my jacket, and prepared the catch ready to unload into my warehouse. Young Dave Barton is usually waiting to help me unload, but there was no sign of him.
"Is he usually late?" I asked suspiciously.
"Not normally. I walk along the jetty to Dave's mum's house. She runs the guest house at the end of the pier. I was just about to knock on the kitchen door when Dave came rushing through it, pushed a bacon butty down his throat and nearly knocked me over."
"Was your catch of fish still there when you got back?"
"Yes," Mr. Stickleback nodded. "Everything was exactly the same as I left it."
I tapped the end of my pen against my teeth as I thought.
"And was there anyone else around at the time?" "Randy Lyons and a few of his boys were preparing his boat ready to go out. Left it a bit late, if you ask me. He's probably got something to do with this. You mark my words, Mr. Winkley."
"It's Pinkley," I corrected.
"Wouldn't trust him any more than I would eat a bloated haddock with 3 eyes and a dose of diarrhoea."
Mr. Stickleback spat on the wharf in disgust. We both instinctively looked towards the warehouse number 3, where the Irish tones of Randy Lyons called out to potential customers strolling up and down the wharf buying their fish. From where I was, I could see the well-stocked trays of fish that lined the floor of his warehouse.
"So what happened when you got back to the boat?"
I asked, stepping away from the slimy globule of phlegm.
"I took my keys out of my coat, unlocked the warehouse, we took the crates of fish off the boat and sent them ready to sell as soon as the wharf market opened.
Then what?"
"I replaced the paddock, looked up and went for some breakfast at Piffany's. We were less than an hour. When I came back, opened up, all the fish had disappeared."
"You're sure the door was definitely locked when you returned?"
"Yes," he confirmed. "I locked it immediately and came to get you. I remember them saying on the telly that you need to preserve the crime scene.
so I knew that's what I should do. I examined the wide wooden doors to the workhouse number 4. Apart from a few dark rust stains dribbling down from the catch in the hinges, there was no sign of a break-in. Out of habit, I straightened the number plaque, which appeared slightly loose, then pulled back the iron latch. The door was securely locked. Mr. Stickleback reached inside his coat pocket for the key, unlocked the padlock, and opened the door. As it pulled out towards us, it snagged on a loose screw that was wedged between two planks of wood in the floor of the wharf. As I kicked it out of the way with the toe of my shoe, I also disturbed some shavings of wood. I looked back at the number plaque and saw the reason why it was loose. One of the screws was missing. "Does anyone else have a key?" I asked Mr. Stickleback.
"No, this is the only one. The spare got eaten by a large alabut I wrestled with last year. I keep meaning to duplicate it, but I never get around to it."
Once the door was open, the light streamed into the empty warehouse. We walked inside. The sides and ceiling were all made of slatted wood that was riveted round a steel frame. The space smelt damp, but there was no sign of water, just rows of plastic crates that should have been filled with the fish ready to sell at the market. Hidden in the shadows at the far end of the warehouse were some thick coils of rope, as well as a large black greasy machine, no doubt used for repairing the boat, but otherwise the warehouse appeared empty.
"So, where do you think they went, Mr. Winkley?" asked Mrs. Stuckelback.
"An interesting question, and I think I have your answer." I paused for effect, waiting for a gasp of amazement, but didn't get one. I continued anyway. "You see, I don't think the fish were ever here in the first place."
"But I unloaded them myself," replied Mrs. Stuckelback. "If there's one thing that's certain, is that I unloaded my fish from my boat and put them on the floor right here."
I walked round the entrance to the warehouse and chewed the end of my pen, trying to look like I was deep in thought. I had seen detectives doing it on television when they were just about to announce the murderer. It all added to the tension and justified my pay. The solution is very simple when you look at the facts. My suspicions began when I noticed that all these warehouses are identical in every way except for the number plaques. I see warehouse number 5 is still missing the number, no doubt blown off in the storm. When we're outside, I could see that your plaque was loose, as it had been hastily removed, or replaced. Beneath the plaque was a dusting of wood shavings, typically created when a screw is removed. I know the screw could only have been removed this morning, any earlier, and the storm would have washed away any trace of it. What if your number plaque had been moved, and what you actually did was unload your catch into someone else's warehouse?
"But that can't be possible. I unlocked the warehouse myself before I unloaded."
"That is the clever part. The key to your warehouse was in your coat, which you left unattended on the wharf when you went to fetch Dave Barton. Enough time for the number plaque to be removed and placed on another identical warehouse. Whilst the key to the new warehouse replaced the old one you had in your pocket. That way, you would think you were opening the padlock to your own warehouse. After you left for breakfast, the number plaque was replaced. Your original padlock removed with the key that had been stolen from your pocket and replaced with the padlock you now had the key to."
"Sounds very complicated, but I'll take your word for it. So, who do you think did it?"
We walked back out to the wharf and looked along the wooden walkway. "Your neighbour, Randy Lyons. You said yourself that he was getting ready to go out when you returned, which you thought was far too late, but now you can see his warehouse is heavily stocked with fish. I believe you unloaded your catch into his warehouse. You now have his padlock on your door, whilst your old one is probably now on his." All those hours sitting inside reading Agatha Christie books while the storm blew through the town had actually paid off. I felt quite pleased with myself. Mr. Stuckelback's face turned to such a violent shade of red that I thought he was about to explode.
"The scoundrel! How can we prove it?"
he asked. "We can't," I answered. "But I would change your lock if I were you." Suddenly my attention was drawn to a small movement in the darkness of warehouse number 4. From around the door to Mr. Stickleback's warehouse, the face of a small tabby cat peered out, licking its lips as it surveyed its surroundings. It trotted onto the wharf, followed by a stream of other cats of all different colours, shapes and sizes. I assumed I was watching all 57 of Mrs. Meekin's cats making their way along the wharf with their bellies starved of food for 4 days now, satisfied and full to the brim with freshly caught fish. Luckily, Mr. Stickleback seemed to be preoccupied, watching his fishing rival to notice the cats.
"Thank you, Mr. Weekly," said Mrs. Stuckelback, shaking my hand. "I will find some way to recoup what I am owed by Mr. Lyons, even if we can't prove this mischievous trick."
With that, he strode towards his neighbour's warehouse with his hands clenched tightly into fists. I took that as my cue to leave quickly before things got ugly between Mr. Stickleback and Mr. Lyons.
I would pop over to Mrs. Meakin on the way back to my office and tell her where her cats had been hiding. I was sure they would find a way back to her in good time, especially if she left out some fresh fish for them. I took one step forward, skidded on a green blob of phlegm, lost my footing and fell face down on the fishing wharf.